We're doing Pirkei Avot with the Jewish home, and we're up to the fifth chapter, the 15th Mishnah. Arba midot bayoshevim lifnei chachamim. You have to hear what the Mishnah is saying. It says there are four types of people who sit before wise men. It didn't say there are four types of talmidei chachamim. It doesn't say that. They're the people who sit before chachamim. Okay. So just because you sat there doesn't mean much. I remember when guys would come to yeshiva and they'd ask me, what year are you? And I'd say, I'm my 10th year. So they'd say, wow, you're in yeshiva for 10 years. And I'd say, what you're so impressed with? All it means is I sat on the bench for 10 years. Doesn't mean I learned anything. You know, a person can sit in a bench and nothing happens. Something's supposed to happen. But the time you spend in yeshiva is not the gauge. The gauge is, where are you? So there are four types of people who sit before wise men. Svog, one is comparable to a sponge. Umashpech, and one is comparable to a funnel. Mishameret, another one is comparable to a type of sift. Venapa, and that's another type of sift. There are two types of sift. The mishameret is like a cheesecloth. No, not like a, like. They used to have a cheesecloth that they used to funnel out wine with, that you'd pour the wine, and all the sediment would get caught by the cloth. So that's a mishameret. A napa is the exact opposite. A napa is a type of sift that lets go of the coarse parts of the flour and holds on to the thin parts of the flour, the refined flour, the white part of the flour. So the students are comparable to that. Sifog shusofegit hakol. You have one student that's like a sponge, and when he sits there, he absorbs everything. He absorbs the jokes, he absorbs the serious things, he absorbs the nonsense. Anything you say, he jots down. We once had, more than once, we've had students like that. That they'd write furiously. Every word you say, you coughed, you think they're writing down cough. I don't know, but they... So you have people like that. Everything you say is recorded. Mashpech, funnel, shemachnis bezo, motzi bezo. That's a student that goes in one ear, comes out the other ear, nothing gets retained. Okay, we all know there are times we're all like that. Mishameret, what? Fifth perek, 15th Mishnah. Mishameret, so that's like the cheesecloth, shemotziyat ayin, that the wine goes out, v'koletet et hashmarim, but only holds on to the sediment. Those are the guys who could leave class and tell you every joke, every story, and no point. Like, what was the point of that story? I don't know, but it was somehow connected to the parasha. Yeah, it was a nice medrash. There was a prince, a princess, a villain. Yeah, it was an interesting medrash, but more than that, okay. So that's, we don't want to be that. Vinapa is the kind of sift shemotziata kemach, lets go of the coarse part of the flour, vekoletet et asolet, and retains the good part of the flour, the refined flour, and that's the type of student that we all want to be. Now, it's interesting because the question is how much of this is our own choice, meaning in other Mishnayot, the Rambam pointed out that it's not up to you. Some people retain quicker, some people slower. And the Rambam was careful to point out where the Mishnah calls a person righteous or wicked, that's with regard to traits that are up to the person. Where the Mishnah simply describes different modes of thinking and different strengths and weaknesses, so there the Rambam says, look, the Mishnah isn't blaming him. People are created differently. Over here, the Rambam doesn't say it explicitly, but we could apply what he said there. I think that we all know that we have a choice. To a certain degree, we have a choice what type of student we're going to be. We could be the guy who only catches the stories, or we could be the guy who catches everything, or we could be the guy who catches what's right, what's important. Or we could be the guy that in one ear, out the other ear. So, to a certain degree, it's up to us. It depends on our focus. I had an interesting thing today. There's a guy who doesn't show up all afternoon Seder. In the Hesder Yeshiva I teach, he declared when he showed up to the Yeshiva, he said, afternoon Seder, I have to work out. So he made this declaration, and he didn't ask. He then went to the Rosh Yeshiva and said, here's the deal. I'm here, I want to learn, but afternoon Seder, I have to work out. So we understood that it was this or not. He's gone. So they decided to go with him on it. Fine. That's their call. But he does show up to Shir. He says, all Seder I work out, I'll show up to Shir at the end of Seder. I won't prepare anything, but I'll show up. So as luck would have it, today he was the only guy in Shir. So a guy shows up to Shir who didn't prepare all the material, and it was a complicated sugya. So we're sitting down and learning, and I'm explaining it to him. He was the only guy there. Okay, so he got a private Shir. He got every word. We flew through the sugya, and he got every word. So I said to him, look, this was complicated stuff we covered today. And you know why you got it? Because you were fully focused on every word. You were focused. So we flew through a whole page, a whole daf of complicated sugiyot in a half hour. And he got every word. Ah, we can all be that way. And it's up to us. Are we going to be focused or not? Now, we have days like this and days like that. And we also know that part of it is beyond our control. Sometimes there's nothing you could do. You get a phone call. I remember I was learning in the library, and I heard that an airplane hit one of the Twin Towers. So,
were you in New York?
I was here. I was here in the library of the yeshiva. I was learning, and someone walks over to me and says, you heard a plane crashed into one of the Twin Towers. So I said, no, I didn't hear.
No, late.
It was in the afternoon, right. So I said to him, nah, I didn't hear. So at first I thought, you know, he's an Israeli, what does he know? You know, Twin Towers, a plane, and stories. I hear people talking, an explosion on the Twin Towers. I'm thinking, come on, what are the odds? And then someone walks over to me and says, no, it's for real. There was a plane that went into the Twin Towers. So I said, okay, what can I do about it? You know, fine. I keep learning, and a few minutes later, someone comes over to me and says, second plane, second Twin Towers. So now, I was already like, we were all wondering, is it war? You know, it started sounding like this wasn't a mistake, this wasn't an accident, right? So now you tell yourself, can I do anything about it? And what should I do about it? So you say, okay, I have to say Perek of Tehillim, and there's nothing really I can do about it, right? So what I can do is help hold the world up by learning Torah and doing mitzvot and davening. Now go focus on a piece of Gemara after they just told you two planes went into the Twin Towers, and you don't know if the war is breaking out now, what's going on in the U.S., right? No one knew. Like, no one knew what was happening. So we have times when we're all like in one ear, out the other ear, or it's very hard to hold on to the information. So we have to remember what David HaMelech said. Shlomo HaMelech in Ecclesiastes, in Koheles, Shlomo HaMelech says, Av chochmati amedali. He says, I dealt with all kinds of things in my life. Av chochmati amedali. And my wisdom, Av chochmati, even my wisdom I was able to hold on to. So our sages learned the verse a little differently. Our sages said, don't read the word af as even, but rather read the word af as anger. We know af could connote anger. So Chazal said, Torah shelamati be'af. Torah that I learned when I was upset. Torah that I learned when I was angry. When I didn't feel like learning and I forced myself and I focused, that's the Torah that stuck with me. We have to know that when we force ourselves to learn, when we really work hard, when we don't feel like learning, when it's the hardest time in the world and you really feel like I can't. And if you push yourself, then you're going, if you really focus, it's at those times that that's going to remain with you. I still remember, this goes back about 6-7 years ago. I had a relative I was accompanying in the hospital. And the doctors let me know that chances are within the next 24 to 36 hours he's going to pass away. So I'm next to that relative, and it's not easy. I know, that's it. This is the last time I'm seeing him. And I had an MP3 player. They were still new things then. And I was listening to Rav Herschel Schachter's shiur on happiness. I had a series on happiness as I'm sitting next to a dying person, And I had to make sure that the nurses were doing what they had to do, because basically everyone had given up on him, meaning they had basically said, you know, it's a matter of time, he's dying. So I had to make sure they're going to put the food into the intravenous, that you know, they're not, you can't let him die of hunger. He's going to die. He did die, you know. Okay, but you got to do what you have to do, make sure the oxygen is there and all that. And the nurses, they have a million other patients to deal with, so that's not exactly their first concern. So I had to spend the night up next to him, making sure that he got what he needed, so that he dies whenever he had to die, which he did. He died the next afternoon. But the whole night, I'm sitting there, like, every 20 minutes, getting up, making sure that he has what he needs. So I'm listening to the shiur on happiness.
Who?
He wasn't with it anymore. That's it. He was out. It wasn't. He didn't know what was going on.
Like, did you ever have to intervene and say that the nurses, like, they forgot stuff, or did they really?
I was on top of it. No, I was on top of it. Meaning they were very busy. That was a tough call, because they told me, you know, if you do too much of this, then that could cause them to die earlier. You do too much of that, and you never know when they're telling you that. Like, you don't know what to make of that. So you're in their hands. I don't know. But what you do know is that if someone's there, then the person gets better care. Meaning, even in halacha, we say that even on Shabbos, someone goes to the hospital and they need real care, not just like stitches. Then the difference between having someone at their side and not can be a difference of life and death. That we see all the time. So that was important. But I still remember that series of shiurim, because I forced myself to be focused. I said, I have no excuse. When I'm davening, I'm davening. When I'm working, I'm working. But when I'm just sitting here, I should be learning. There's no excuse not to. So I forced myself. And till today, those are shiurim that are a part of me, because it was the hardest thing in the world to be focused on your learning when that's the scenario a person's in. So yes, we all have aspects where we're sometimes a funnel and sometimes we're in one ear out the other ear, but sometimes we could really get hold of ourselves and focus, and it's not only that we can do it, but if we force ourselves to do it, we'll have so much more for it. I got asked a very interesting question this past Shabbos, which pertains to our Mishnah. We were sitting with a young couple, and the wife asked me, is there a way of saying yes, dear, in every language? Meaning, that's the most common thing that husbands do. He's reading the newspaper and she's going on and on. You know, and when I got those new shoes, I thought they would be so good. And then they started squeaking on me, and he's like, yes, dear. And did you also think that's the way it would be? Yes, dear. So then why didn't you tell me beforehand? Yes, dear. Oh, no, I'm sorry. You know. So there's this tendency that men have, that what women say goes in one ear and out the other ear, because it's a little bit challenging for us to have the conversations the way they have them. There was a woman wrote a very, very nice article about how she was home one evening and her husband called and said, you know, I'm stuck in traffic and it's going to take me another 2-3 hours to get home. And she said, sure, dear, okay, I'm waiting for you, and hung up the phone and got very upset. And then she says, well, what am I upset about? She turns on the radio and she hears this bumper-to-bumper traffic, and it's not her husband's fault, he can't get home, but she was still upset. So she says, she writes there, what was I upset about? Two things. Number one, why didn't he take a helicopter and come home? Oh, so he'll say, wait, I don't have a helicopter. What does she want from me? Right, but what she wants of you is, say that you wish you had a helicopter. Meaning, there are two ways of saying I'm stuck in bumper to bumper traffic. The male way of saying I'm stuck in bumper to bumper traffic is, I'm stuck in bumper to bumper traffic, right? That's the male way. What's the female way of saying I'm stuck in bumper to bumper traffic? I miss you, I wish I would have been home, I can't believe I'm stuck here, this is so frustrating. That's what she wants to hear. Just one second. She added another interesting point. She said, I wish he would have said to me like this, I'm stuck behind this red bus that keeps blowing smog into my face, and, meaning, she wants details. You understand? You catch the difference? Does she care that he's stuck behind the bus with smog in his face? Yes. Do I care? No. If she calls me up and says, I'm stuck behind this bus and he couldn't believe it, he's blowing smog into my face, and I'm sitting behind him and I can't get out, and the people are so rude here and I can't get to the other lane, I'm thinking, like, what's she telling me, right? What do I need to know that for? I feel bad. Your one sentence could have done the job. I'm stuck in traffic. I understood, yes? That's the male way of talking. Not only do females talk differently, they want to be spoken to differently. So we will never talk like a woman so long as we're healthy men. And I'm not asking you to talk like a woman, but take it into account. Both ways. When you talk to her, add a few details. It'll make her happy. And when she talks to you, don't be like a funnel. It shouldn't be in one ear, out the other ear. Register. Partake. She wants that participation in conversation. Part of the problem that men have in conversation is they think they're always supposed to be listening. You see, you guys are sitting here silent for about 20 minutes already. If you were women, you'd have a lot to say in conversation. That's why women are very often...
You can tell it, Rabbi.
Very good, Yehuda. So I see your marriageable material already. One thing you have down pat.
Finally, they recognize it.
Okay, Uri, we're with you.
Hey, I was going to say something interesting happened. My sister was leaving for Israel, and I was still in Texas, and she said, you know, I'm leaving, and I have all these feelings, blah, 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 like, talking to me. I'm playing video games, and like, yeah, like, it's bad and stuff. And she's like, yeah, I'm leaving, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, it's bad and stuff. And she's like, and it's like talking to me, like, yeah, it's not good. Yeah, and so, like, I bet she got frustrated. We got in a fight before. And then she's like, I don't think you even care that I'm going to, you know, like, you don't even care. Like, you know, how can you be this? It was a big problem. Like, and I left not, she left not on good terms because she got the feeling that I didn't care that she was leaving because I was in, like, real, like, emotional about it. But that, like, that was my way of dealing with it because I was in emotional about it, you know?
Well, you also play Xbox 360. Change everything.
Okay, we'll do one more Mishnah. The Rambam doesn't say it about this Mishnah. I think that...
it sounds like you are in control.
I think that going by the Rambam's formula from previous Mishnayot, my impression is that the Rambam... I'll read you the Rambam. The Rambam says, a person that has a good memory and doesn't discern between what's true and false is like a sponge. And whoever understands right away but doesn't remember anything, doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong, that's like a funnel. A person that remembers the bad, the things that are wrong, but can't remember the things that are right, that's like the cheesecloth that funnels out the sediment. And a person who is who's the other way, he always remembers what's right, so that's like the correct sifter. And that's the best way that a person should be. But the way he describes it, if you compare it to his description of previous Mishnayot, it definitely seems like he's saying it's not up to a person. That the Rambam seems to learn that these Mishnayot, when they don't say wicked or righteous, good and bad, they're describing temperaments. They're describing something that's inborn. So I think that we should apply what we've been saying all along, that we all have each of these traits to a certain degree, and it's up to us to try and maximize the correct part of it. I'm sometimes shocked with what people walk away with from a class. Sometimes I get to hear a conversation after class, and it blows my mind what people retain from class. Sometimes in a good way. Sometimes I say a sentence and I don't even realize how people took that sentence. But it's up to us what we're going to walk away with. I think to a degree it is up to us. Even though from the Rambam it seems like it's not. I have to say that using the Rambam's formulas from previous Mishnayot, it seems like the Rambam's learning that this is about the different types of people that are out there, and then we would say that the lesson that the Mishnah is teaching us is to be patient with people. And you'll sometimes have this. This brings us to another interesting point.
It sounds like it's more for the teacher rather than the student.
Right, right. If we're going to learn like the Rambam, that different people have different temperaments, so then I have to tell you a story. I wish I could tell you who the person is, because he said this story publicly here in front of you guys. But there was once a rabbi who came here and said the following story. So he got married, and the first week he got married, he prepared this whole Dvar Torah for his wife because they're finally married. He was a Chozer B'tshuva, and they had known one another for ages. Like, I don't know, I think for at least a decade they were boyfriend and girlfriend. And then they both went along the ways and became frum, and then actually got married. And then he's preparing this Dvar Torah for the first Friday night. And they're sitting at the Shabbos table, and he starts talking, and he has a 20-minute long speech. And after about the third minute, he hears a noise. Right, you got it. She's snoring. So he had two shockers at the same table. One, she wasn't deeply interested in his whole long Hasidish pilpul vart. Two, she snores. So two surprises for the price of one. But I often tell people that if you want to learn together with your spouse, so don't be surprised if it's not going to work the way you expect, that you're going to prepare this great Dvar Torah, and she's totally disinterested. And it could still work. And that's why I'm not a fan of learning Chavrusa on dates, because I don't think that reflects too much on anything. So you're not a good Chavrusa. Rabbi Akiva Eiger's wife couldn't read or write. So okay, and they still had a beautiful marriage. Okay. I'm not telling you to look for someone illiterate. I'm just saying that's not necessarily the gauge of what's right. You're not marrying a partner in Torah. You're marrying a partner in life. And you have to have patience for that. Men get very frustrated when they try to talk Torah with their wives. And, you know, you're going to tell her Dvar Torah about how Moshe split the sea with a staff. And she's going to ask you, what was the staff made out of? And he's like, why is that important? I don't understand. And she'll say, wait a second. Did he lift it up? Did he extend it? How did it work? Was it a second before? Was it a second after? When was it? Aren't you interested in details? Okay. Yeah. So I tell men, be prepared for a lot of frustration if you're going to talk Torah with your wives. And maybe prepare things along the lines that they're going to be interested in. So I expect that a man will prepare Dvar Torah that's not male-oriented, but female-oriented. Prepare a Dvar Torah that has a nice idea, a nice theme, a nice medrash. But don't try to, you know, and if they go off on tangents, just pay attention, fine. You know, it's par for the course. But I think it also helps when you realize this is how it goes in every house. And the comfort is that when you'll have children, Bezrat Hashem, you'll be able to tell them the Divrei Torah, and then she'll actually hear what you have to say. When it's your wife, usually you can't get beyond sentence two without her asking a few questions, and then you get sidetracked, and you get all frustrated. You had this whole thought you wanted to share with her, and you never got to base two. And I see you know exactly what I'm talking about. So I think that I sometimes suggest that couples do something else. If they can be civil enough to talk to one another, so then... I say, can you make a deal? Like, could you ask her, I have a thought, and you're going to ask me a bunch of questions, and then I'm going to lose my train of thought, and then I'm never going to share it with you. So can you give me 3 minutes to tell it to you, and then you'll ask your questions, and then you'll only get about three questions during those 3 minutes, not 15.
But you'll find that she's formulating questions and you hang on to them and not even listen to what you're saying, because...
Sometimes... Sometimes, and sometimes she's going to say... What?
That she could also get insulting, because you're like, you're going to ask way too many questions. Like,
so I wouldn't say it that way. I would say... Right, but you could say, you know, can we get back to that in a minute? She'll never get back to it, don't worry.
Yeah.
but yeah, you tell her, you know, I just want to finish the thought, and then we'll get back to it. It works to a degree, you know, more or less. But don't get frustrated. That's the way it works. That's a very interesting question. I had a guy who insisted that his parents, all their marital troubles stemmed from the fact that one of them snored. I think that people have to find solutions. If it's earplugs, if it's playing music in the background, if it's falling asleep first.
There's some things these days, like you have like medical.
Try to make
medical. Yeah, it's like it just opens up your nose. It works.
I always found sleeping in another room worked.
So I'm happy you brought that up. We have a lot of guys here who think, who have raised that. Every year we have someone who raises that. And part of what we assume in marriage is that you guys sleep in the same room. And even if one person's ill, unless it's something like contagious and who knows what, but short of that, you belong in the same room. And that should not be an option, because then... there's a very integral part of the marriage that ends up becoming a vacuum, and it should be there, even though it's tough. I think that should not be an option. Going to sleep in another room. Yeah.
Between the same bed and two separate beds, some families have two different beds.
So the idea is that part of the laws of family purity is that when the woman has her onset, once her period begins, so then the couple are biblically prohibited from being intimate. And they also separate the beds. That's one of the things that were instituted to ensure that we don't end up forgetting ourselves, which might sound funny, but the truth is that in the middle of the night, you're thinking today. Think down the road, 20 years down the road. You've been with the same person. It's like second nature to you that you're with that person. It's not something you think about. I mean, you think about, but you don't think about it. It's a part of life that the two of you are together. So then... It could very easily happen that a person forgets himself in the middle of the night. Now, when you're first married, so then it's you're not used to it, so you're fully awake. Once you're married for a while, so then you're awake, but not as awake, and a person could easily forget himself. So that's why the way we do it is either that the couple have two beds and they separate the beds. When they're prohibited, and they're prohibited until she goes to mikvah. Or else, sometimes couples have one big bed, and then when they're prohibited, the husband rolls out a cot or something. Some couples prefer having a big bed, and then the husband, so long as he's comfortable sleeping on a cot. I say the husband, because I assume you guys are gentlemen. a little bed, you know, a little mattress that he lays out on the floor or something. Which has its advantages and disadvantages, whatever. But that's the way people sometimes set it up. But right, they have twin beds that can connect in a way that you really don't sense that they're two beds. They,
it's two mattresses. The other bed goes like this, eh?
Right, but they also have inserts that you could put in that make it that you put the sheet and covers both of them with an insert. And then it's like one. It's possible. So people can do whatever they want. Saying some people prefer, like you're saying, having a big bed. Some people have a big bed and a small bed. Some people have a big bed and then a cot or something, whatever the husband's comfortable sleeping on. And again, I say the husband, because you guys will be gentlemen. Yes. Okay. Why are you guys laughing? I'm serious. I'm not joking. Okay. Okay. I'd like to believe you. Okay. We're short on time, so we'll